You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Acra, hands-on community radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
This is Carmen Borgia.
And John Sturman. We're the hosts of Ukuleles Unleashed,
where you'll hear.
And also.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, you listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. The name of the show, Good Night, Norman.
Coming to you live on WGXC 90.7 FM on your radio dial. Right here in beautiful downtown Hudson, New York, broadcasting from Columbia and Greene counties in upstate New York. thank goodness. Tonight, before we go on, with a couple of stories. We're in the middle of a fun drive. That's right. WGXC is a nonprofit community radio. We depend for this show and many others on, guess what? Your dollars. Why don't you call up? Write in, make a pledge, do your part, and donate money where you have never donated money before. Obviously, what I'm doing here is unpaid work, but I enjoy it. Lots of you probably do unpaid work as well. But if you can spare anything, $1 a month, $10 a month, $100 a month, all we're really asking for is to be able to reach our goal of $5,000 a month. Excuse me. Want you to check it out at wavefarm.org/WF/support and all the information you need to become a supporter of community radio right here in the good old USA. It's there on the page. Okay, now without further ado, our first story Really sorry about that. By Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. It's called My Mother is a Crazy African. It's from an anthology. The title of which is called One World, a global anthology of short stories. This is edited by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie along with Chumpa Lahiri. It includes several authors. Once again, My Mother is a Crazy African by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I hate having an accent. I hate it when people ask me to repeat things sometimes, and I can hear them laughing inside because I am not American. Now I reply to Father's Igbo with English. I would do it with my mother too, but I don't think she would go for that just yet. When people ask where I'm from, Mother wants me to say Nigeria. The first time I said Philadelphia, she said, say Nigeria. The second time, she slapped the back of my head and asked in Igbo, is something wrong with your head? By then, I had started school, and I told her Americans don't do it that way. You are from where you are born, or where you live, or where you intend to live for a long time. Take Kathy. She is from Chicago because she was born there. Her brother is from here, Philadelphia, because he was born in Jefferson Hospital. But their father, who was born in Atlanta, is now from Philadelphia because he lives there. Americans don't care about that nonsense of being from your ancestral village where your forefathers owned land, where you can trace your lineage back hundreds of years. So you trace your lineage back, so what? I still say I am from Philadelphia when my mother is not there. I will only say Nigeria when someone says something about my accent, and then I always add, but I live in Philadelphia with my family. Just like I call myself Lynn when mother isn't there. She likes to go on and on how Rolindo is a beautiful Igbo name, how it means so much to her. That name, choose life, because of what she went through, because of my brothers who died as babies. And I am sorry, don't get me wrong, but a name like Rolindo and an accent are too much for me right now, especially now that Matt and I are together. When my friends call, Mother goes, Lynn, for a second, as though she doesn't know who that is. You would think she hasn't been here 3 whole years. Sometimes I tell people 6 years, the way she acts. She still likes to end observations with America, like at restaurants. See how much food these people are wasting? America. Or at the store. See how much they have marked down the prices from last week? America. It's a lot better now, though. She no longer crosses herself, shivering whenever a murder is reported on the news. She no longer peers at father's written directions as she drives to the grocery or the mall. She still has the directions in father's precise hand in the glove compartment, though. She still clutches the wheels tight and glances often at the rearview mirror for police cars. And I have taken to saying, Mother, the American police do not just stop you. You have to do something wrong first, like speed. I admit, I was awed too when we first came. I looked at the house, and I understood why Father did not want to send for us right after he finished his residency, why he chose to work for 3 years, a regular job as well as moonlighting. I like to go outside then and just stare at the house, at the elegance of the stone exterior, at the way the lawn wrapped around it like a blanket dyed the color of unripe mangoes. And inside, I like the curving stairs in the hall, the gleaming banister, the quaint marble fireplace that made me feel as though I was on the set of a foreign film. I even like the clump, clump, clump sound the hardwood floors made when I walked in my shoes, unlike the silent cement floors back home. The sound of the wood floors bothers me now, when Father has some of his colleagues from the hospital over, and I am in the basement. Father doesn't ask Mother to get a little something together for his guest anymore. He has people deliver small trays of cheese and fruit. They used to fight about that, Father telling her white people did not care about moi moi and chin chin, the things she wanted to make, and Mother telling him in Igbo to be proud of who he was and offer it to them first and see if they don't like it. Now they fight about how Mother behaves at the get-togethers. You have to talk to them more, Father says. Make them feel like they are welcome. Stop speaking to me in Igbo when they are here. And Mother will screech. So now I cannot speak my language in my own house? Tell me, do they change their behavior when you go to their house? They are not real fights. Not like Kathy's parents, who end with shattered glass that Kathy cleans up before school so her little sister won't see. Mother will still wake up early to lay out Father's shirt on his bed, to make his breakfast, to put his lunch in a container. Father could cook when he was alone. He lived alone in America for almost 7 years. But now, suddenly, he can't cook. He can't even cover a pot after himself. No, he can't even help himself to food from a pot. Mother is horrified when he so much as goes close to the stovetop. You cooked well, Chica, Father says in Igbo, after every meal. Mother smiles, and I know she is plotting what soup to cook next, what new vegetable to try. All her meals have a Nigerian base, but she likes to experiment, and she has learned to improvise for the things that are not in the African store. Baking potatoes for Ede, spinach for Ugo. She even figured out how to make farina, so real, it had the consistency of fufu. Before Father taught her the way to the African store, where there is cassava flour. She no longer refuses to buy frozen pizza and fries, but she still grunts when I eat them, still says that they suck blood, such bad food. Each day she cooks a new soup, which is almost every day. She makes me eat it. She watches as I mold the fufu into reluctant balls and dip them in the chunky soup. She even watches my throat while I swallow, as if to see the balls go down and stay down. I think she likes it when the people I call our accidental guests come, because they're always over-enthusiastic about her cooking. They're always Nigerians. Always new to America. They look up names in the phone book looking for Nigerians. The Igbo ones tell Father how refreshing it was to see Eze, an Igbo name, after streams of the Yoruba Adebisis and Ademolas. But of course, they add while wolfing down Mother's fried plantains, in America, every Nigerian is your brother. When Mother makes me come out to greet them, I speak English to their Igbo, thinking that they should not be here, that they are here only because of the accident of our being Nigerian. They usually stay only a few days until they figure out what to do. Father is adamant about that, and until they go, I never speak Igbo to them. Kathy likes to come over to meet them. She is fascinated by them. She talks to them, ask them about their lives in Nigeria. Those people love to talk about victimhood, how they suffered at the hands of soldiers, bosses, husbands, in-laws. Kathy has too much sympathy, in my opinion. Once she even gave a resume to her mother, who gave it to someone else who employed the Nigerian. Kathy is cool. She's the only person I can really talk to, but sometimes I think she shouldn't spend so much time with our accidental guest because she starts to sound like mother without the scolding tone when she says things like, you should be proud of your accent and your country, and I say yes. I'm proud of America. I'm American, even if I still only have a green card. She says it about Matt, too. How I shouldn't try too hard to be American for him, because if he was real, he'd like me anyway. This is because I used to make her say words so I would practice and get the right American inflections. I wish Nigeria hadn't been a British colony. It's so hard to lose the way they stress their words on the wrong syllables. Please, I have seen Matt laugh at the Indian boy with the name that nobody can pronounce. The poor kid's accent is so thick he can't even say his name audibly. At least that's one person I'm better than. Matt doesn't even know my name as Ralindu. He knows my parents are from Africa and thinks Africa is a country, and that's about it. It was the sparkling stud in his left ear that struck me at first. Now it is everything about him, even the way he walks, throwing his legs way in front of his body. It took a while before he noticed me. Kathy helped. She'd walk boldly up to him and ask him to sit with us at lunch. One day she asked, Lynn is hot, isn't she? And he said yes. She doesn't like him, though. But then, Kathy and I don't like the same things. It's what makes our friendship so real. Mother used to be cautious about Kathy. She'd say, Ngwa, don't stay too long at their house. Don't eat there either. They might think that we have no food of our own. She really thought Americans have the same stupid hang-ups people back home have. You did not visit people all the time unless they reciprocated, unless it would seem as though you were not gracious. You did not eat at people's homes because multiple times if they had not eaten at yours. Please. She even made me stop going over for a month or so, about 2 years ago. It was our first summer here. My school had a family cookout. Father was on call, so Mother and I went alone. I wondered if Mother used the dark saucers on her face she calls eyes. Couldn't she see that Americans wore shorts and t-shirts in the summer? She wore a stiff dress, blue with white wide lapels. She stood with the other mothers, all chic in shorts and t-shirts, and looked like the clueless woman who overdressed for the barbecue. I avoided her most of the time. There were a number of black mothers there, so any of them could have been my mother. At dinner that evening, I told her Kathy's mother asked me to call her Miriam. She looked up, a question in her eyes. Miriam is her first name, I said, and then I plunged in quickly. I think Kathy should call you Chica. Mother continued to chew a chunk of meat from her soup silently. Then she looked up. Dark eyes blazed across the table. Igbo words burst out. Do you want me to slap the teeth out of your mouth? Since when have little children called their elders by their first name? I said sorry and looked down to mold my fufu extra carefully. Looking her in the eyes usually prompted her to follow up on her threats. I couldn't go to Kathy's for a month after that, but Mother let Kathy come over. Kathy would join Mother and me in the kitchen, and sometimes she and Mother would talk for hours without me. Now Kathy doesn't say hi to Mother. She says good afternoon or good morning, because Mother told her that is how Nigerian children greet adults. She doesn't call Mother Mrs. Eze. She calls her Auntie. She thinks a lot of things about Mother are great, like the way she walks, regal, or the way she speaks, melodious. Mother doesn't even make an effort to say things the American way. She still says boot instead of trunk, for God's sake. Oh, Mother hugging me when I got my period. Such a warm thing to do. Her mother simply said, oh, and they went out and bought pads and panties. When Mother hugged me, though, 2 years ago, pressing me close as though I won a big race, I didn't think it was a warm gesture at all. I wanted to push her away. She smelled sour, like Anubu soup. She said what a blessing it was, how I would bear children someday, how I had to keep my legs close together so I didn't bring shame on her. I knew she would call Nigeria later and tell my aunts and Mama Nuku, and then they would talk about the strong children I would bear someday, the good husband I would find. Matt is coming over today. We are writing a paper together. Mother has been walking up and down the house. In Nigeria, girls make friends with girls and boys make friends with boys. With a girl and a boy, it is not just friends. It is something more. I tell Mother it's different in America, and she says she knows. She places a plate of fresh fried chin-chin on the dining table, where Matt and I will work. When she goes back upstairs, I take the chin-chin into the kitchen. I can imagine Matt's face as he says, "What the hell is that?" Mother comes out and puts the chin-chin back. "It is for your guest," she says. The phone rings and I pray that it will keep her long. The doorbell rings and there is Matt, earning glittering, holding a folder. Earring glittering, not earning. Matt and I study for a while. Mother comes in, and when he says hi, she stares at him, pauses, and then says, "How are you?" She asks if we are almost done in Igbo. And before I say yes, I pause for a long moment, so Matt won't think I understand Igbo so easily. Mother goes upstairs and shuts her door. "Let's go to your room and listen to a CD," Matt says after a while. "My room's a mess," I say, instead of "my mom would never let a boy in my room." "Well, let's go to the couch then. I'm tired." We sit on the couch and he puts a hand under my t-shirt. I hold his hand just through my shirt. "Come on," he says. His breathing is as urgent as his voice. I let go and his hand snakes under my shirt, encloses a breast sheathed in a nylon bra. Then quickly it weaves its way to my back and unhooks my bra. Matt is good. Even I cannot unhook my bra that quickly with one hand. His hand snakes back and encloses the bare breast. I moan because it feels good, and I know that is what I am supposed to do. In the movies, the women's faces always turn rapt right about this point. He's frenetic now, like he has a malaria fever. He pushes me back, pulls my shirt up so it bunches around my neck, takes my bra off. I feel a sudden coolness on my exposed upper body, sticky warm moistness on my breast. I once read a book where a man sucked his wife's breast so hard he left nothing for the baby. Matt is sucking like that man. Then I hear a door open. I grab Matt's head up and pull my shirt on in the space of a second. My bra, startling white against the tan of the furniture, is blinking at me. I shove it behind the sofa just as Mother walks in. "Isn't it time for your guest to leave?" she asks in Igbo. I am afraid to look at Matt. I am afraid he will have milk on his lips. "He was just leaving," I say in English. Mother continues to stand there. I say to Matt, "I guess you better get going." He's standing, picking up papers from the table. "Yeah, good night." Mother stands motionless, looking at us both. "He was talking to you, Mother. He said good night." She nods, arms folded, staring. Suddenly a burst of Igbo words. Was I crazy to have a boy stay that long? She thought I had good sense. When did we leave the dining table and come to the couch? Why were we sitting so close? Matt shuffles to the door as she talks. His sneaker laces have come undone and flap as he walks. "See you later," he says at the door. Mother finds the bra behind the couch almost immediately.
She stares at it for a long time before she asks me to go to my room. She comes up a moment later. Her lips are clenched tight. Ibo Evigi, she says, take your clothes off. I watch her surprised, but I slowly undress. Everything, she says, when she sees that I still have my panties on. Sit on the bed. Spread your legs. My heart beats wildly in my ears. I settle on the bed, spread-eagled. She comes closer, kneels before me, and I see what she is holding. Osensuka, the hot twisted peppers that Mama Nuku sends dried from Nigeria in little bottles that originally held curry or thyme. Mother, no. Do you see this pepper, she asks. Do you see it? This is what they do to girls who are promiscuous. This is what they do to girls who do not use the brain in their heads, but the one between their legs. She brings the pepper so close that I pee right there and feel the warm wetness on the mattress. But she doesn't put it in. She is shouting in Igbo. I watch her, the way her charcoal eyes gleam with tears. And I wish I was Kathy. Kathy's mom apologizes after she punishes Kathy. She asks Kathy to go to her room. She grounds Kathy for a few hours, or at most a day. The next day, Matt says, laughing, your mom weirded me out last night. She's a crazy-ass African. My lips feel too stiff to laugh. He is looking at some other girl as we talk. Okay. That was Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, my mother, the crazy African. Next story I'm going to read is titled The House of Deformities. It's by Nnedi Okorafor. It's from a collection of hers called Kabu Kabu, The House of Deformities. Ngozi scowled and clapped her hands over her ears, but she couldn't do it for long because she needed to hang on to the van door. She tried to relax as the orange van rattled loudly down the speed-limitless road, but the faster the van went, the more it shook. Ngozi didn't know how everyone else could stand it. In the front of the van, her parents and the driver were all laughing and blabbing about just about everything. Gee, I can't remember the last time I had cassava. It's almost impossible to find in the United States, her mother was saying. Yes, well, you have 6 more days to enjoy it, the driver said. Ngozi scrunched her face. She hated cassava. The smell prevented her from getting it even close to her mouth. Sharp and pungent in taste, cassava was worse than eating celery, and she absolutely hated celery. Ngozi's 12-year-old little sister, Adwabi, loved it and ate it with the fervor that she normally reserved for plum. But at the moment, Adwabi probably wasn't thinking about cassava. Adwabi sat beside Ngozi, absorbed in another one of her scary books. This one was by Stephen King, The Talisman. Ngozi bit her lip as she watched her sister read. How does she do it, she wondered. She should be carsick as hell, but you probably have to be aware of your surroundings to get carsick. When her sister got into a book, she might as well have physically flown to a different world. Adwabi had been reading the book since they had boarded the plane back home in Chicago. She read through the entire flight to London and continued reading through the flight from London to Port Harcourt, Nigeria. She kept reading through the ride to the village and for plenty of nights by candlelight in the village. The talisman gave Adwabi sweet nightmares every night. But she still read on, craving every page. For Adwabi, The book had spiced up the world. She walked around with wide eyes that often annoyed Ngozi. "Why don't you calm down or something?" Ngozi told her sister once when she saw Adwabi staring at the forest behind the village. "You look stupid and stuff." Adwabi had grinned. "You just don't get it," Adwabi said. "It's like everything around us is alive. Look at all the trees." Ngozi had only rolled her eyes at her dreamy sister. It was better just to ignore Adwabi's strangeness. One night, they were sitting on the balcony. The generator had run out of gas, and everyone simply decided to turn in early for the night instead of wasting energy trying to stay cool. Ngozi had tried to sleep, but it was too hot. Adwabi was sitting cross-legged on the concrete balcony floor, reading by candlelight. Though it was a sweltering night, a strong breeze waved the trees back and forth, making a shh sound. Ngozi froze, a shiver running up her spine despite the heat. She glanced at Adwabi, who had stopped reading and was looking out into the moonlit forest that was a sea of rippling leaves. "There have to be monsters in there," Adwabi said. "Yeah, big, looming monsters with huge blue bug eyes and white jagged claws that could easily break up skin." "Oh, bullcrap," Ngozi said, rolling her eyes. "Those books are like drugs and they're giving you hallucinations." "I can't help it, though," Adwabi said with a giggle. "I am addicted." "Whatever," Ngozi said, going back inside. She sucked her teeth in imitation, the way she heard her cousins do it, and quickly went inside. She'd rather sweat indoors than be with whatever was out there. "Man, whatever yourself," Adwabi said. "You never listen to me." "Weirdos aren't meant to be heard," Ngozi said. "You're the weirdo," Adwabi grumbled, going back to her book. "Your head's like all dried up and stuff." Now, in the rickety van on their way back to the airport, Ngozi saw Adwabi's shoulders shiver, and she felt more annoyed. Though Adwabi was only 2 years younger than she was, she could be so babyish. It was always Ngozi's bed that Adwabi crawled into when she got scared at night, and Adwabi snored like a sleeping dragon. "Whatever," Ngozi thought. "I think she likes being scared or something. There's no other reason why I should keep reading that stuff." The wind whipped a braid into her face. She glanced at it and pushed it back. When she and Adwabi first stepped off the airplane into the heat of Nigeria, their braids were black, but now they had a reddish tint from the dust that swirled around. Ngozi wondered if either of them would be able to wash it out when they got home. Adwabi didn't really care. "Dust is natural," Adwabi said. "Man, whatever, you dirty dirt lady," Ngozi said. Ngozi and her sister teamed up with their cousins, Grace and Rose, throughout most of the 2-week visit to their father's village. Rose and Adwabi were the same age, and Grace and Ngozi were also the same age. The four girls, looking like four sisters, were inseparable. Adwabi and Rose had a special love for wildlife. They spent hours and hours mucking around in the bushes and red dirt. The day they smuggled in the robust green stick bug under the dinner table still made Ngozi's skin crawl. The vile thing had somehow ended up on the table next to the bowl of Yolof rice. Ngozi remembered that insect was cleaning itself. Neither of their mothers had been happy. In Ngozi's opinion, she and Grace were much more mature than Adwabi and Rose. Adventure was what they were interested in, not creepy insects and slimy lizards. Ngozi giggled at how scared Adwabi got when the four of them snuck out to an old oracle one moonlit night deep in the forest behind the village. It was Ngozi's idea. Adwabi refused to go unless Ngozi made a grand promise to her. I hereby promise to buy you the new Clive Barker book hardcover the minute it comes out in return for you risking your life visiting a haunted, scary place at my request, Ngozi had to recite before Adu Abi and her cousins. It turned out to be a worthwhile exchange, for a haunted, scary place was exactly what it was, at least in Adu Abi's opinion. With flashlights, they trudged into the tall palm trees and thorny bushes, following what their cousin Grace called a path, but was really no more than gaps between the trees. Adu Abi clung to Ngozi the entire time, jumping at every hoot and screech. Adu Abi said she was sure there were lumbering monsters and hungry headhunters watching them, waiting for the right moment to strike. Maybe if you didn't constantly scare yourself with those stupid books, Ngozi snapped. It's just an old place, that's all. The temple, made of thick slabs of gray stone, was covered with flowering vines, dark green lizards scampering up the sides. Rose said it hadn't been used in decades. Yeah, since the missionaries invaded and made people believe that a blue-eyed blonde Jesus was their savior, Rose spat. She grumbled something in Igbo and then said, "You should see my mother. She is truly brainwashed. Oh." Rose had stood behind the stone altar and recited spells she'd heard a year ago when she had snooped around the local medicine man's hut. Her older sister, Grace, superstitiously crossed herself. "Stop playing around," she snapped. "You are so stupid." Rose only laughed. "Do you think all that Christian stuff is going to help against the old religion? You're confused, girl." Rose giggled. At that moment, Adu Abi stumbled across a pile of old chicken bones and gasped, leaping over to her sister and burying her head in Ngozi's shoulder. "Those are only the bones of chickens, silly," said Rose, picking one up. "Their necks were wrung as sacrifice to the gods." "You know," Grace said, "in the paper the other day, there was a story about how these men are practicing black magic. They've been kidnapping children and cutting off their heads and using their brains and grinding up their skulls for powerful potions." Adu Abi gasped, glancing around into the shadows. "What?" Ngozi said, holding her sister's hand. "No, you're making that up," Rose said. "I can read too, you know. There is nothing about black magic. That's just a word these white people like to use to make us afraid of our own power. Don't make me tell you off." "You are such a little barbarian, Rose," Grace said. "You're too childish to tell me off." Rose sucked her teeth, scowling at her sister. Then she turned to her American cousins. "It just said that there have been children disappearing lately," she said. "Rumor has it that before the child disappears, there's a man wearing a black hat hanging around. He probably hangs around places like this for stupid girls like you who believe this nonsense," Grace spat. "I don't believe it," Rose said. "I just don't." That was when the breeze picked up. It was a cool night, but the breeze was warm. Later on, Adu Abi said, it was the breath of whatever ruled the forest. Ngozi didn't know what it was. All she wanted to do was forget that burst of hot air and that smelled like wet soil and mulch after it rained. All four of the girls had frozen, staring at each other with huge eyes barely lit by the half moon above. Then they all took off, swallowing their screams. They were out at an hour that would get them beaten by their mothers, and even in their hour, they knew to remain quiet. Adu Abi didn't stop shaking until they had climbed back into their room through the window, and she was under her covers. "Now here she is, subjecting herself to more of that," Ngozi thought. "Whatever," she grumbled, staring out one of the open windows, letting the air blow her face. They passed markets where women sold cocoyam, dried fish, oranges, tomatoes, and egusi. Goats were tied to the trunks of trees, and chickens lay on the ground, unable to walk because their legs were tied. She tried to take in as much of southeastern Nigeria as she could. There was only a week before it was time to go. Back to the United States, the thought made her heart drop. Man, who knows when we'll be back here? The trip from their father's village to the Sheridan Hotel in Lagos would be about 6 hours long, the driver said. Of course, this didn't include the traffic and potholes and haughty military men who like to make travelers unpack everything in their vehicle until the travelers decided to just pay them off. If they actually caught anyone carrying drugs or anything else that was supposedly illegal, I bet they'd let people go if they gave them some of the stuff, Gozi had angrily said as they pulled away from some military men an hour ago. Gozi had eyed her sister as the man with dark, smooth skin wearing the green beret and carrying the very big gun walked around the van. I swear, man, she said right after. When he came to my side, I swear I saw his fingers on the trigger, and his nails were long, like the nails of a sloth. And did you see his eyes? They were wild, man, like he was just waiting for a reason to shoot. Adwabi, one of these days you're going to have a heart attack, Ngozi said. She actually thought the military man was quite good looking, and she certainly didn't find men with nails long as a sloth very attractive. They were stopping again. Gozi looked out the window. Adwabi looked up from her book. What are we stopping here for? Outside was what Ngozi thought was a restaurant. People sat at a wobbly table drinking Fanta and Star and Heineken beer and dishing up fufu with their hands and dipping it in spicy okra origusi soup. The front of the restaurant was open. Adwabi wondered what they did when it rained. She could see two women cooking in a kitchen-like area at the back. She couldn't see, but she imagined that they were sweating and probably very tired. We're stopping here for some drinks, so if you have to go to the bathroom, Ike says it's around the back, their father said, stretching his long arms. Their parents had become a lot more relaxed over the last 3 weeks. They were thousands of miles away from their busy lawyer lives. Gozi was glad to see them without their beepers and having such a great time. They hadn't been back to Nigeria since before she was born, which Ngozi thought was way too long. Gozi looked at the decrepit building with a rusting red tin gate. The air smelled of burnt marshmallows and highlife was playing from a radio somewhere inside. There was smoke billowing from the back, and behind the whole building was lush forest. Come on, Adwabi, Ngozi said, grabbing her arm. I have to go to the bathroom, and I'm not going behind there by myself. Ngozi, I really do not like this place, Adwabi said, trying not to sound as scared as she was. I don't know if I even want to drink anything from here. Something's not right. Oh, man, come on, Ngozi said, rolling her eyes. It's like stumbling across a circle of mushrooms, knowing not to step into it, but not knowing why, Adwabi desperately said. Whatever, her sister said dismissively, pulling off the elastic band that held her foot-long braids in a ponytail. She let them cascade into her face. The driver said he stops her all the time, and if the place wasn't safe, we wouldn't be here. The driver seemed to have been everywhere. He knew every twist and turn, every pothole, how to get around almost all traffic jams, or at least how to lose the least amount of time in one. And he was the most skilled driver Ngozi and Adwabi had ever seen. They had watched him maneuver the van through amazingly tight squeezes. He wove through a traffic jam with such ease, people around him got irritated when they couldn't follow him. One man had even spit on the van as it passed. The saliva globule had dried on the car door. Oh, fine. Good. God, Adwabi said, snatching her arm from Ngozi's long-nailed grasp.
As she walked toward the building, Gozi could hear Adwabi dragging her white sandals in the red dirt. Gozi frowned, but she did not look back at her sister. The closer she got to the building, the more she felt a sense of doom, but she'd never admit such a silly thing. I'm not gonna let Adwabi's stupidity rub off on me, she thought. She looked up at the looming shack and quickly looked down at her feet in the dirt. There was a dim red haze that radiated from the building like heat. Come on, man, Gozi said. Walk faster. I gotta go back. I'm coming. Cool it, Adwabi said. It's not my fault you didn't go at the last stop. I'm sick of going in the damn bushes, and Gozi snapped, opening the white gate to the back. You're lucky you didn't get bitten on the ass by a snake or something. Whatever, Adwabi said, following Gozi through the gate. As soon as she stepped in, she ran into her sister. What are... She heard the yipping before she saw them, and when she saw them, her jaw dropped. It was a bizarre procession that looked as if it had come right out of Adwabi's head. Coming toward Ngozi and her sister was a herd of puppies, yipping and tumbling over one another. Their fur was a soft, sandy brown, their tiny paws white. Bulldogs. What the? Then she noticed something else. Some of the puppies were limping. And they were limping because they had no choice. They each had only three legs. In place of where the fourth leg should have been were smooth, furry stumps. Gozi stared until her eyes got dry. She'd seen a story on the news once about a three-legged dog, but she'd never seen one in real life. How the heck were they able to move so fast? In between tumbles, they got quite a few steps in. And she wasn't merely hearing the yip-yips of the puppies. There were also tweet-tweets. Running amongst the puppies were pink baby ducks. As if this wasn't strange enough, the babies kept falling too. Baby ducks kept falling too as they tried to keep up with the puppies. They were bow-legged. Pink baby ducks and puppies, Adwabi whispered. What's wrong with them? Gozi barely heard her sister. She couldn't seem to drag her eyes from the strange sight that was circling around her sandals. The puppies and ducks ran around the girl's feet, quacking and yapping and falling. A few of the dogs mewled at Adwabi's ankle, smearing saliva on her skin. Ew! Adwabi screeched, rubbing her leg against her ankle. Then the strange ducks and crippled pups ran through the open gate. Gozi and Adwabi watched as they scuttled into the dusty parking lot like a school of fish, the slightest movement sending them all in another random direction. But not so random, for they moved in circles, never beyond the parking lot. Ngozi shrugged and began to make her way farther into the back, her urge to urinate reminding her of why they had opened the gate in the first place. Adwabi reluctantly followed her sister and said, "Man, the bushes are way better than this. This... House of Deformity," she grumbled. "What the hell did we just see, anyway? Pink baby ducks and messed up puppies running around together as if they were the same freaking genius and genus and species and stuff? What kind of..." "Will you shut up," Gozi said with a look of urgency on her face. She had no idea what kind of weird shit they had just seen. What she knew was that she was through using nature as her toilet. God. What was it about Nigeria and the simple toilet anyway? Or should she say, lack of it? That was one thing she had not been able to get used to. She had minded washing with cold buckets of water, not having electricity after 8 o'clock, eating one big meal a day, or the lack of television. She and her sister had adapted easily to Nigeria indeed. They loved the food, they picked up a little of the language. Adwabi had even carried well water on her head with Rose and Grace every day of their last week at the village. Ngozi had refused, saying it made her neck hurt, but the issue of having no toilet had not been easy for Ngozi to deal with. When there was an actual toilet with actual plumbing that worked, there was always some plump, venomous-looking spider hanging out in the bathroom or a nasty wall gecko scampering in its prickly manner on the ceiling, or enormous cockroaches swimming up from the bowels of the toilet like water beetles. All wildlife seemed to migrate to the bathroom, and when there was no bathroom and she had to find a place outside, Ngozi was in constant fear of snakes,
mosquitoes, some other sickening organism, or some pervert seeing her. I'll make it real fast, okay? Gozer said. Thunk. They rounded the side of the shack and came to what looked like a backyard, or more like a clearing, for there was no fence to hold the forest behind at bay. Thunk. An old woman of less than 5 feet with skin as black as the pelt of a panther stood behind a thick wooden table with machete in her left hand. Sweat glistened on her thin-looking, wrinkled skin. She brought the machete down again. Thunk. Behind the woman was a metal barrel with smoke billowing from it. The forest crept in close behind. The outhouses were just past the woman to the left. Sitting on the ground against the restaurant's back door was a man. He had his legs pulled close to him. You think he's asleep? Adawabi whispered. She gasped and roughly grabbed her sister's arm. It was midday, and the sun felt especially hot. Ngozi could feel the sweat dripping from the sides of her arms. What? Ngozi hissed. That man over there, Adawabi whispered. Oh, I hope he can't hear us. What about him? Ngozi said, moving forward. Adawabi moved with her, her eyes still on the man. He's wearing a black hat, she whispered loudly. So what? Don't you remember what Grace said about the kidnapping man? Ngozi thought for a minute, and then she remembered. She glanced at the man. The hat was covering his eyes. Well, he's asleep, she whispered. Let me go to the bathroom and then we'll get out of here. We don't want to make it obvious that we know who he is and stuff. Ngozi had no idea whether or not he was that bad man Grace had mentioned. She didn't really believe Grace's story, but better safe than sorry. The two girls walked past the sleeping man and the woman, trying to mind their own business. There were 3 outhouses with 10 roofs. Adawabi walked with her eyes cast to the red dirt ground. Ngozi couldn't help but stare at what was on the table that the woman was chopping and what was swarming around and on it. It looked like the entrails of some animal, and there was a lot of it, enough to cover the entire table. Maybe they were the legs of the puppies, she thought, or maybe they were chopped up whole puppies and ducks, and it was the meat that they put in the okra soup that they were serving with the pufu out in front. Her lip curled in disgust. The woman took no notice of the flies, which rose up in a buzzing swarm around her head whenever she brought the machete down. The woman watched Ngozi with smirking eyes. She gazed blankly back. How is she not cutting her finger? Ngozi wondered. She's not even looking. She took a deep breath, trying to calm herself, and then looked straight ahead at the outhouses. She stopped. Once again, Adawabi bumped into her sister's back. What? Adawabi hissed. Look up, her sister whispered, sounding as if she were about to cry. Adawabi looked up. Perched on top of the outhouses were 4 large black vultures. Wow, she whispered, fascinated. The birds were almost as big as the girls, sitting hunched forward, their tiny heads dwarfed by their meaty bodies. Never fails, Ngozi thought. What is up with creatures in bathrooms? Is it some kind of sick, perverse attraction, or are they just comfortable around poop and pee? Ngozi suddenly understood why the birds were there, the better to watch the meat. She could hear their long talons clacking on the roof. There were 5 more vultures standing behind the woman in front of the smoking barrel, their heads pointing towards what was on the table, waiting for a scrap to accidentally fall on the ground so they could snatch it up. They didn't dare get too close to the woman. She could probably do some damage to them with that big knife, Ngozi thought. One, the woman said suddenly in a deep, heavily accented voice. They're no interest in you. Go, Adawabi whispered, shoving Ngozi toward the big birds. One of the vultures softly squawked and pecked at the vulture next to it, who raised its enormous wings and hopped away sideways. The sound of their talons clacking on the tin grated at Ngozi's nerves. The hot air had grown completely still, as if to amplify the sound. Fine, fine, I'm going, Ngozi said, slapping her sister's hand away and looking at the woman. The woman waved an encouraging hand to her. Come with me a little closer, then I'll go, Ngozi said to her sister, no longer caring how her fear showed. Please, it's scary, okay? Adawabi took her sister's hand, and the two slowly crept toward the outhouse. Behind them, they could hear the old woman chuckling to herself in between chops. Yeah, I know she finds this hilarious as hell, Gozy thought. Two Americanized Nigerian girls too afraid of a few birds to relieve themselves. Wouldn't be the first time people have laughed at us for that kind of reason. But these thoughts didn't make her any less afraid. The closer they got to the outhouses, the closer they got to the nasty vultures with the nasty long talons. Adoabi stared at the creature above the outhouse on the far left, the one that Gozi was leading them to. It locked its eyes on Adoabi. Gozi could see its haggard-looking orangish-yellow beak, which had probably torn apart many a dead animal, maybe some alive. It tapped its claws on the tin and ruffled its greasy-looking black feathers. A tiny squeak came from Adoabi as she tried her best to stay brave. Gozi didn't want to know what Stephen King-induced monsters and demons were going through her sister's head. Gozi reached for the outhouse door, pulled it open, and they both jumped back. They felt a gust of hot, foul-smelling air waft past them, a smell of disease, waste, and rot, and something else. Inside was nothing but a big hole in the ground. Gozi couldn't see the bottom. Maybe that was for the better. But she did hear the buzzing of millions of flies. She slapped the back of her neck, and then her leg. Gozi turned around and looked at Adoabi. When she made eye contact, she knew that she and her sister were hearing the same thing, the same two things. The first was coming from the pit, through the noise of the flies, howls and sobs, all high-pitched in voice, like children, thousands of them, and the sound was coming from far away, far beneath. The second new sound was coming from behind them, a wheezy laugh. If either of the teenage girls knew the disease, they'd have described it as an emphysema-tinted guffaw. "That man," Adoabi whispered, tears welling in her eyes. "That man. He wasn't asleep. He was only pretending." "Come on," Gozi shouted, pulling her sister, knowing if her sister resisted, she'd still sprint away. "Let's go. Let's get out of here, man." Gozi took one last look as her legs began to move. She saw tendrils of smoke snaking from the lips of the pit over the red dirt around it. Then she snapped her head around and took off. She didn't care if she sounded like Adoabi. She was positive that the hole in the ground led to another world, a terrible one. The buzzing had sounded as if it were coming from far away, as if the hole was the entrance to a world filled with rotten decay and millions of blowflies. And soon they would congregate and rush out of the hole in a putrid swarm. It was the place where all those children had been taken. The Gozi had forgotten her urge to pee. They ran past the herd of ducks and dogs who had found their way back into the yard and out the white gate. They didn't stop until they were in the van. Gozi slammed the door hard. The two girls sat huddled together on the hard wooden seat, their hearts beating faster than ever. For once, Gozi didn't mind Adoabi's tears. Though she didn't cry herself, Gozi felt like she would. She peered out the window at the looming forest and shivered. A slight breeze waved